working? Yeah, I guess it is. If you're joining us, you've joined the FERC Finance and Budget Meeting, City of Miami Beach. With that, Rafael, can you let everybody know how they can join if they wish to remotely?
Sure. Good morning. So today's meeting of the Finance and Economic Resiliency Committee has been scheduled in a hybrid format with the committee physically present and staff and members of the public appearing either in person or virtually by Zoom. In order to participate in today's meeting virtually, members of the public may dial 1-888-475-4499 and enter the webinar ID, which is 863-6059-5462#. Or you may log into the Zoom app and enter the webinar ID, which again is 863-6059-5462. Any individual wishing to speak on an item must click the raise hand icon if you're using the Zoom app, or dial *9 if you're participating by phone.
And Jason, you've got some announcements, I think.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Item number one on the GMCVB is withdrawn. Item 8, which is discuss funding for educational enhancements, is deferred until the December FERC. Number 17, which is the waste hauler item, has a time certain of 9:30. Number 18 on the football championship Orange Bowl committee is at 10 a.m. Also wanted to announce that the October FERC meeting is officially moved from October 20th to the 16th at 9:30 a.m., and that the November FERC is canceled. That
Great.
Is all. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jason. And then item 4 is, I think, Jose Transportation. We're going to do this very briefly, and then I'm going to close this item. So I know good morning, Jose.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
So we've talked about this is a big item that got a lot of different pieces to it, but we had talked about what we're all calling Española Way East. So can you give us an update on that? As my understanding, I guess the county didn't want to move forward until we get Ocean Drive resolved. So tell us what if there's any update.
Yes, sir. Good morning. Jose Gonzalez, Transportation and Mobility Director. Mr. Chair, you are correct. In terms of the status, we are exactly where we were a month ago. We've completed the design. The design has been the design of the tactical urbanism improvements for Española Way East has been provided to Miami-Dade County. It is in their hands. The only comment we received back is that until the Ocean Drive promenade permitting issue is resolved, they are not amenable to approving any other street closures in the area, including Española Way East.
Okay, great. All right, so this is my item, and we all know I'm going to be making a departure here soon, so I'm going to close the item today, and I would encourage my colleague. So I'm going to close it, but here's what I want to I want to encourage my colleague to bring separate items. The thing is, this item is like literally three or four different pieces, right? And there's no action on the other one on Drexel, so I would rather close this out and then and leave it clean as I depart. And then if you want to bring one on specific to Española Way, I would encourage you to do that. And then there could be another one on Española Way West and another one on Drexel, but this is really the issue that's in front of us right now. So with that, we'll show that
thank
closed.
You.
And then thank you so much. And Alba, where's Alba? You've got a housing item. What item is that, Jason?
That'd be item 6, discuss protection for tenants. The request from FERC was to return with an update from the legal services.
Okay. So go ahead. You're recognized.
Good morning. Alba Tarre, Office of Housing and Community Services. This is the quarterly update on benchmarks and metrics for the Legal Services Tenant Defense Program, sponsored by Commissioner Fernandez and funded through home ARP funds. Legal Services takes walk-in clients and appointments every Thursday from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. and 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. at our Office of Housing and Community Services Walk-in Center. From January to July 2023, our office has made 77 referrals to Legal Services for issues associated with tenant rights, including evictions and issues with repairs not completed by the landlords. We continue working with the city's marketing and communication department to promote the program, as well as have placed two advertisements on bus shelters and a digital platform located inside the Alton Road Food Hall. Legal Services has also conducted several tenant workshops, and we will continue to work with them to coordinate additional workshops in the months to come. Mr. Jeffrey Hearn, who's the Chief Advocacy Officer, is here and available to provide legislative updates on the preemption bills.
Go ahead. Good morning. You're recognized.
Thank you. So Alba asked me to come and speak about the preemption bill that was enacted by the legislature this year. You know, this was the result of local governments like Miami Beach enacting additional protections for their tenants. Miami Beach was a leader in that. In the 1990s, they expanded the notice requirement to 30 days. In the past year, both Miami Beach and Miami-Dade County expanded the notice period to 60 days, including for the rent increases. And Miami-Dade County enacted the Tenants Bill of Rights, which provided some additional protections. Those have now been preempted by the state legislature. You know, the one, I guess, silver lining for the rest of the state is that the notice period has now come forward to what Miami Beach set back in the 90s statewide to 30 days. So that was kind of one of the give and takes as part of that legislation. It's a broad preemption that regulates anything related to the landlord-tenant relationship. The question is kind of what's left over. One area of concern are our human rights ordinances. Miami-Dade County has a very broad one. You know, it's our belief that those are not preempted. They're not regulating the landlord-tenant relationship. It comes from a different chapter in the state law. You know, the LGBT protections are now part of the Fair Housing Act because of how we define sex. But we have additional protections like domestic violence and veteran status that I think will be questioned, and most importantly, source of income discrimination, which is used to protect Section 8 voucher recipients. So we'll find out what the courts do with that. And then I think another question is this relocation assistance when buildings close down. Miami Beach has an ordinance. The county has an ordinance. The Miami-Dade ordinance is very clearly applies to both residential tenancies and other buildings like condos. So I think there may be a question about whether those are preempted or not, and those are, you know, fights for another day in the courtroom. So
when the preemption was passed last year, so it became effective July 1st?
Correct.
And is there something in the courts right now?
Not that I'm aware of. You know, the biggest impact for us and for the residents of Miami Beach is the 60-day notice, losing the 60-day notice. Because we all know that nobody can move. At the time you enacted it, it was 15 days, and nobody can move in 15 days. Yeah. Moving in 30 days is a challenge. So losing that month to find housing has made a significant impact on our clients and on your residents.
Okay, great. Gentlemen, any questions? You want to keep this open and bring it back in January next, like it's a quarterly update?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that would be great, and I think this was an update requested by the Vice Chair Arriola. And I'd like to ask Alba, would it be possible to coordinate a virtual workshop for our tenants? I know when we had the in-person workshop, my office got flooded with requests from individuals because they work and have odd schedules that they would not be able to attend. Is there that possibility?
Absolutely. We've talked to Legal Services and to their staff, and they're open and ready to do any sort of, whether it be hybrid or whether it's in-person or virtual. They're
great.
Open.
Let's circle back after our meeting today so we can coordinate that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think this was your item, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And so did you transfer it? Because it's got your name on it now.
I don't know. I had worked on the legal assistance on aspect of it, and I think Commissioner Arriola had requested updates because I think it's very important not just to create these programs, but how are they working? Are they being efficient and delivering positive results? And Commissioner Arriola,
I don't remember, you know, whose name.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. I think also where my name was used. Can you hear me?
No. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Stay close.
Okay. Yeah. I think where maybe. There might be some confusion. I had sort of a related companion item, which had to do with legal aid services and reaching out to the county to find out how they can assist us in this type of endeavor. So all with a view towards trying to help our residents who are experiencing, you know, housing issues and may not have the economic means to take on a landlord. You know, what kind of services we could be providing them.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right.
And before we move on to our city administration, to our communications department, who always do a great job, these services are only as good as they're communicated out to our constituency, to our community. And so I just ask, please just continue communicating this out there so that our residents can benefit from this program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. So what we'll do, Jason, is show this for January.
You want this? Okay.
This is
to return in January for an update?
Back for another quarterly update in January unless he decides to defer it. That's his choice. Okay? So I'd like to call item 7. That's the Tyler Technologies update. So I think that's yours, Frank. And this is an update, and then I've got an additional request to add something to this that I'll talk to you guys about. Go ahead, Frank. You're recognized.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the board. So this is part of our standing item that was brought forth by Commissioner Arriola close to 2 years ago to provide an update on the overall picture of our investments with Tyler Technologies, the different applications we have, and where we stand. So as a brief overview, once again, the city uses a number of Tyler products. It does our financial systems, HR, licensing, permitting, inspection, and our 911 and dispatch public safety operations. Over the last 6 months, we've completed a number of yearly scheduled updates, which put us more in line with the recommended new set of features, new security functionality for the systems. We've done one for Munis, which was successful. We worked on the InterGov upgrade in the spring, which brought us a number of enhancements and improvements and fixes for some of the issues. And in conjunction with that, we've also worked with a number of city departments to work on assessments for all of these different lines. One of the assessments, which I believe we'll be speaking to a little more in detail at another time, was a permitting process assessment, and that was done by a consultant, which was supported by Commissioner Fernandez, and we've come to completion on that. There's a final report with findings on that. There were some components that were technical in nature for improvements, mostly around communication, and there were several other elements that we'll also cover more in detail. We've also initiated a gap assessment with Tyler regarding their Munis platform for financials and HR, and that is something that kicked off 2 weeks ago internally with all departments. The intent there is to see what we have configured and what we've done with Munis since it's been several years since the application has been here, find out what gaps there are, where there's opportunities to improve configurations or training. And we are also closing an independent assessment with a different consulting agency regarding the public safety side of it, so 911 dispatch and all of the policing and fire systems, and we expect to have a final report on that yet. That's all to say that we've actively worked on assessing what we have and not taking for granted that just because a technology is here that it's the best or that it's being used to its maximum capacity. Last week during commission, the board approved a number of enhancements and a contract amendment. Half of those were related to public safety initiatives. One of them was very technical in nature, and the last was an improvement to InterGov, which will allow a more seamless and informational type of function for our residents trying to open permits. Out of all the items that we brought, beginning probably 12 to 18 months ago of areas for improvement, there was one product that we were still evaluating called Tyler Payments. And essentially, Tyler Payments would work in conjunction with our current bank, and I'll let Jason speak to anything that he wants to highlight, work with our current bank, but allow a more seamless integration for our residents. So if you're coming to pay any one of your bills, whether it's water billing or any other type of interaction financially that you have with the city, it would give you that one cart experience that we're all used to, where you go to a website and add to cart, and then you can finally process that. So it's a customer service enhancement option. There are a number of other efficiencies internally for reconciliation and accounts payable and accounts receivable, which affect Jason's shop. We're still evaluating that. It's been an interdepartmental effort between Jason's team and my own. And I'm sorry. I was going through my notes. That covers the extent of the Tyler Payments one. I'll let Jason speak to that.
Go ahead, Jason, because I think this is an item that we can take action on today, right? Go ahead.
A little bit of an update.
You
we're
tell
still
me.
Looking at, but thank you, Chair. So as Frank said, you know, one of the items that we work on is, you know, obviously collecting credit card payments from our customers. One of the elements we looked at in, is both cost and customer service perspective from this. The city, predating me, had looked at it from a procurement perspective, and it ended up being the bids ended up being rejected. It was a very it's a very complex, very technical process. Every one of these vendors have a black box, effectively, of figuring out how their billing structure is. In analyzing it, we realized that our existing pantheon, I would call it, because there are several different merchant providers. We have a very low cost structure, but it's really from a customer service perspective we're looking at now. So once we determine that it's the low cost structure, you know, we do have to deal with it contractually. But in talking with IT, there is elements where we probably would end up spending a little bit more money, but in the big scheme of things, from a customer service perspective, it may become more important. Now, the city is working to implement the utility billing module for that, so that may push this down the line. Obviously, we are always hesitant and look very, very carefully whenever we're coming for an amendment that involves a bid waiver. So we're very careful in that analysis, and that's something that we're obviously very hesitant, you know, to do. But we're going to look real closely, especially with the utility billing gets rolled out over the next few months, to see how that works and to see from a customer service perspective if it does make sense to come back and ask for that to be added for the time of Tyler Payment Solutions to be added for that. But as of right now, I don't think we're looking to have a specific action.
Okay, so we're not looking to do that today.
Yeah, but I just wanted to give an update because it is something that there was a previous resolution to throw out for us to continue that analysis. The analysis continues. But it is important to note for the record, we are in a low-cost structure. So from a cost perspective, we're good at how we are. But we will have to eventually get into an actual, you know, executed contract situation. But from a customer service perspective, because we are so tied, this is just how the world works. We may be in a situation where Tyler Payment Solutions makes the most sense. But we're obviously very hesitant, you know, to be bringing that kind of thing. But we'll keep analyzing it, and we'll come back and brief when necessary. Thank you.
Okay, great. And then, Commissioner, you'll I've got an item that I'd like to add.
Go ahead.
And I want you to entertain this. So the city engaged a consultant to review the permitting process. Tyler is used for that process. So, Eric, why don't you come on up, because I got a couple of questions for you. So it's my understanding the consultant has finished their work. They had 14 comments, recommendations. Staff is now working on action items to address those 14 items. So what I would propose is that at the next FERC meeting, October 16th now, we ask city to present those 14 items and their action items related to those 14 items so that we know that, you know, one of the things we've been trying to do in the city is improve the permitting process. And then we can react to that and then tweak it and then send it back to the commission for the October 18th meeting. To accept the action items from the staff. So that's what I'd like to do. First of all, let me ask you, are you okay? It's your item if we do it that way.
Yeah, my I think I've had this as a standing item for close to 8 years, ever since I came into office. You know, I heard complaints from, you know, residents and others that our system's buggy. You know, it's still not perfect. And so, you know, I keep asking, you know, did we make a mistake? Do we want to stay with this technology, or do we want to, you know, start looking for something else? You know, I'm not the user of the technology, but I just hear complaints. And so, you know, I don't know that the complaints have gone away. You know, what I hear from staff, you know, over the years, all 8 years, it's sort of this non-committal, vague. Nobody wants to make a hard recommendation. They certainly don't want to say scrap it and go somewhere else. So I feel like it's got to be a commission-led decision, which is not the way to do it because we're not the users. All we hear about is from the community that the system is buggy, and it hasn't, from what I hear, it hasn't gotten better. My frustration is no one's giving me a firm recommendation is, Commissioner Ariola, we got to move on to something else. It's sort of like, we'll work with this consultant, we'll keep spending money.
I understand implementations are really cumbersome. They're pain in the neck for, you know, for the team. But sometimes that's what you got to do in order to make an advancement. I'm only here another month, so, you know, I'm not going to make the decision to scrap it or not. But I worry that this is going to have to be a commission-led decision because nobody is telling me that we got to go in another direction. And so I don't know that that's the right answer, but it's the same answer I've gotten for 8 years. Well, you know, it's going to get better. We got to get another consultant to come in here. It's literally the same conversation I've had going back to 2016.
Vice Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner, at the last City Commission meeting, one of our colleagues was almost echoing exactly the sentiment that you've expressed now and you've expressed in the past in this committee and you've been expressing now for a number of years. You've been leading with that sentiment. I would say that it's easier when these changes do come with a professional recommendation, with a recommendation from our staff. But I don't know how a new city commission is going to feel about this. I don't know if a new city commission is going to be willing to make this type of a drastic change. But the change has to be done. The change has to be done because the people that are suffering are the people who are trying to invest in our city, who are trying to use these platforms to go through the process of opening up their businesses and getting their licenses and their renewals and et cetera. I would encourage you, before you leave office, let's discuss this again at the City Commission, because this is one of those things that they're important. And I usually like to go with staff's recommendation on this, but the reality is that what about the recommendation of the public? Of the public that is using this and that constantly is reaching out to our offices, and when we engage them in the streets, they're telling us their frustrations with these systems. Maybe it is the time now, before you leave office, to make a change like this.
Okay, so Eric, on the consultant's report, you've got that. You and the staff are working on your action items related to that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And so can you be ready on October 16th to come back, present the 14 items that we got from the consultant and your reaction to those or the action items? Can you be ready on the 16th?
Certainly. We can have that conversation on the 16th. I just want everybody to know, obviously, we've been meeting all the department heads that touch the permitting process on at least a biweekly basis, more frequently on a weekly basis. And I think that we've already made a lot of the improvements that are touched on in the report. Some of them, obviously, are beyond our control, outside jurisdictions that have to touch our permitting process. Technology is a big piece of the user experience. The one thing that I would say is that I don't think there's a silver bullet on the technology side. And so I do caution us going too far down a path of changing for change sake.
Okay. All right. So then
I have one more question.
Sure. Go ahead.
Sorry. Is LaserFish in any way tied to our relationship with Tyler Technologies?
No, it is not. It is a separate product altogether.
Okay. Over the years, first as a resident, now as an elected official, I've noticed that LaserFish is not too reliable often. Now, you try to research and you try to access information, and after you try to access something a few times, the system just stops working, and it gives you all sorts of errors, and then it will stop working for a day. Like, you can't access anything at all after you access something a couple of times. Let's circle back on that, if you could meet with me, because I need to understand what is the issue with LaserFish. That is where our historical records and access to information is at. And I have concerns, especially when you have change of leadership. That is how we preserve institutional knowledge, through the records that we maintain. And that later on you try to access those records, or the public tries to access them, and they're not accessible. So let's have a meeting on that at some point.
Okay, so we'll, Jason, we're going to show this coming back on October 16th for the purpose of reviewing the permitting consultant's report and having staff give us the 14 points and your action items. And then it would be my goal that the committee review that, tweak, make recommendations, and then put that on the agenda, the commission agenda, on the 18th to adopt the action items. That would be my goal.
Okay.
So that we can keep this, hopefully, improvement in the permitting process moving forward.
Okay. I'll just show for the record that IT provided an update on the status of the Tyler system and permitting process, discussed the possible interest in moving the Tyler payment solutions for the merchant ID credit cards, and then a return on October 16th to give an update on the consultant's report on the permitting process.
Perfect.
Thank you.
With the action items that the city's taking, with the goal of putting that back on the commission at the 18th. Okay, Raquel, I know you've got a couple of items. I know you've got another meeting, so let's... I think you've got item number 5. Is that correct?
Yes, number 5 and number 14.
Okay, so do we need to call up number 5? Or this is an update on the economic development steps regarding possible seating in the Normandy Fountain. So go ahead. You're recognized on item 5.
Good morning, Honorable Chair and Commissioners. Raquel Williams, Assistant City Manager. So at the direction of this committee, the Economic Development Department, along with the Public Works Department, the Facilities and Fleet Department, as well as the City Attorney's Office, convened to identify possible alternatives to provide for outdoor seating in the Normandy Fountain area. Staff also met with local businesses through the Normandy Fountain Business Association and provided information on the city's outdoor dining concession program. What we determined is that while these restaurants are interested in having outdoor seating, they may not be ready to or willing to participate in the city's outdoor dining concession program. Therefore, we are recommending that the city provide outdoor seating on a trial basis of 12 months. We're recommending that the seating be temporary and movable so that we can evaluate during the trial period. We have also identified that there are labor costs associated with storing and removing that furniture to prevent theft and vandalism, which has been experienced in the past. Those labor costs would be associated with city employees. We have also identified that there could be an alternative by expanding an existing vendor's agreement to provide programming and actually add the responsibility of storage and maintenance of these temporary seating fixtures. Alternatively, the city could provide this, and I just wanted to bring that to your attention that we see two possible routes for this and would advise that a temporary 12-month pilot would allow us to determine if the restaurants and the local businesses and residents are really utilizing this seating opportunity.
Okay. Guys, Commissioner Ariola.
Yeah, I mean, again, we invested a lot of money and time to make what I think is a really great, beautiful public space. And it is used, particularly when, you know, the city or the Normandy Fountain
Business Association
activates it. But, organically from the businesses, it's not taking place, you know, like I've said before. You know, the comments that have been made to me is just the lack of sort of maybe clarity or, lack of clarity, let's say, as to, you know, the ability of businesses to have outdoor seating, the number and stuff like that, and, you know, maybe some red tape involved. I want to hear from my colleagues, you know, to give staff direction. Is it our policy to try to make this, you know, a priority to try to remove some red tape, to try to get that activated so the businesses can say confidently, hey, I can put whatever the number is, 100 seats out there and not run into interference from the city because we've got, you know, some policy somewhere that says you can't do more than, you know, 20. I, for one, would like to push us to do more. We can always scale back, but we got to give businesses an incentive or at least,
you know, an attractive opportunity to make that investment so that they know that they can have, you know, outdoor seating without, you know, a lot of, you know, red tape that, that prevents them from doing that. So that's what I'd like us to urge our staff to try to make happen.
Commissioner, go ahead.
Thank you so much. I see this very simply. When we speak with our police and you want to improve an area, they tell you positive activation. When you speak with the folks from economic development and you ask them, you want to improve an area, positive activation. We invest in positive activations all the time. You look at our budget, even in this area of the Fountain, we're investing in positive activation. But those are positive activations that we're investing in so that others produce for us. But the best type of positive activation that I believe we can invest in is ones that help for it to occur organically from the business activity there. Because we may go once a week with our investment, but allowing these businesses to be there 7 days a week, operating every day, and allowing their customers, our residents, to use these spaces, that's the best type of consistent and ongoing positive activation that will help the economy and revitalize an area with good energy. But sometimes our own red tape gets in our own way. What is most frustrating for me is that I see that the cost, and Commissioner Arreola, you know, this is, you know, one of these things. You speak about bureaucracy a lot of times. Our own bureaucracy. The cost of the table is $1,000, but then the cost to maintain the table, $115,000. We should be embarrassed that this is even written in a memo. This should have never been written in a memo because that was the death sentence for this item. In place here to be a death sentence for this item. It's like saying, I'm going to buy a pencil. We're going to place an order for a pencil that costs $2, but we need to hire someone for $60,000 to sharpen the pencil. That's not an efficient use of our resources. And I am embarrassed that we put here that to buy a table for $1,000, we need to have $115,000 just for daily activation plus $50,000 for weekend activation. That, it frustrates me. But I think we need to look at how we can put these tables there. Let's reach out to the Fountain Association and see if they're willing to take on this responsibility of maintaining the tables. And don't we already have public works staff that is there, that is supposed to be going there and cleaning this area, maintaining this area, that could also be doing this?
Commissioner, if I may clarify.
Through the chair, I'll yield, yeah, through the chair.
Go ahead.
The administration is not recommending that staff be responsible for these duties. We have recommended in the conclusion of the memorandum that a third party be contracted to assist with these services. We're particularly interested in augmenting the existing contract of the Normandy Fountain Business Association that provides programming in the area. And we believe that the Normandy Fountain Business Association may be the most well-suited entity to provide for this service and to enhance the needs of the stakeholders as well as the city. Okay. So these costs are provided just for informational purposes because this would be added responsibilities or added duties for our facilities and fleet management department. This does not include sanitation services or maintenance. Sanitation would typically be provided by our sanitation division within our public works department. And the more activation or the more seating and the more food and beverage operations that are happening in the Fountain, that will require additional sanitation services. So we feel that a third-party entity would be the best route.
Yeah, go ahead.
Good morning, Raquel. maybe I missed it in the memo, but I don't think it was included in the analysis. What if we, you know, let's just say for argument's sake, we approach it along the lines of what you outline here, where we make the capital investment, and you know, maybe the city takes on some of the responsibility for the maintenance. Do you have revenue to offset that? Meaning,
You know, maybe we make a deal with the restaurant operators that, you know, we take a percent of sales or something to maybe offset some of this, where we basically say, look, the capital investment is the city's, the cleanup will be the city's, but your customers are going to enjoy all these tables. If you're going to take the tables, you know, we're going to take a piece of sales, just like we do with, you know, a lot of other tenants.
We have not explored that opportunity. One of the reasons is that there are three restaurants that abut the plaza. We would like for the tables that the city would provide to be utilized by any restaurant in the Normandy Fountain area, even beyond those directly abutting the plaza, to really make it for sure. Public use. And so we wouldn't necessarily want to burden those three restaurants if other restaurants in the area, if their patrons would be able to utilize it. So that was not something that we initially explored, but we could, but that was the reason. We didn't want to totally just benefit those three restaurants and then have the other restaurants that are a little further out feel like they weren't getting the full benefit either.
But there may be a hybrid to, so for example, how many tables and chairs are those three restaurants allowed to have? Are they limited to 10 chairs and or 10 tables, or do you know?
So it's all depending on their grease trap and their capacity, whatever the requirements are in place stipulated by DERM, which is out of the city's purview. They would go through our application process, and that would determine how much outdoor seating they could either transfer from inside to the outside or how many they could add. So when we sort of surveyed or did the outreach to the restaurants, it didn't appear that this was something that they wanted to proceed with. And we offered them, you know, support in filling out the application. We let them know that we would be there to support them in whatever they needed at the county. But it appears that the restaurants just wants the city to provide for seating. And so we recommend that we put this seating on the elevated area, which is not just directly in front of those three restaurants, because the elevated area has greater visibility, and it would promote usage by everybody in the neighborhood, not just those three restaurants.
So what I was thinking, and maybe you need to work on this a little bit more, you need some more time, but what I was thinking is that if you offered in exchange the three restaurants that are there, maybe they would take on providing or maintaining the tables and chairs, bringing them in and taking them out for the other areas if they got some sort of fee waiver for the chairs outside their restaurant. I don't know how we do that. There's a way to do it. I was just in New York, and Bryant Park has tables and chairs all over the park, and anyone can go and just use those tables and chairs. Same thing in Boston. The tables and chairs in a public area, and everybody's out using the tables and chairs. So somehow they figured out how to do that.
Restaurants in that area currently do not have to pay for the fee to have the outdoor dining concession. So that
they don't.
They do not. That's one of the incentives for North Beach businesses. So they already do not have to pay that.
But the problem there, if I may.
Go ahead.
The problem there, it was not our fees. The problem was that by putting the fees, it was technically an expansion of their occupancy, which was resulting in the county coming, again, bureaucracy and red tape coming in and saying, DERM was saying, now you need to put in a new grease trap. Well, that's a death sentence for some of these small businesses that were trying to get to flourish there, that now they need to close down for a certain amount of time, rip up their floors, get these permits, and it's going to take months of income and rent for some of these businesses. And so that's why we were looking at perhaps this model of, well, what if the city puts the tables and the chairs out there to kind of help these small businesses without causing a direct increase in their occupancy load for these businesses. What I would encourage, hearing the conversation from my colleagues, is that rather than putting this responsibility on one business, because it should be for the use of all businesses there, what if we approach the association? The association, which is the umbrella of all the businesses, and ask them, as the association, are you willing to help us manage these tables? And then the association can figure out an arrangement with the businesses or independently on how to effectuate that. What do you guys think?
So why don't we then give you direction to request a meeting with the Normandy Fountain Business Association. Let's bring this back on October 16th. See if we can move this forward a little bit. See if they have some ideas on. Obviously, they can't do it for free. So let's Let's find out. So, because I really need to, we got a full schedule. I need to move on to the next item. Is that okay, guys? We'll bring this back on. In the meantime, you reach out to the association, ask for a meeting. Let's see if we can't get a little closer on this. And then you also have, I think, item, was it 14?
Yes.
Okay.
Discuss development
on the West Lots. Let's try to do this quickly if we can. Go ahead.
Today I'm joined by our Parks and Recreation Director, John Rebar, as well as our Facilities and Fleet Management Interim Director, Elizabeth Miro. The memorandum in your package provides a comprehensive overview of the West Lots, including its history in terms of ownership, status, planning history, as well as current uses and uses permitted by the city. So there have been several planning studies over the decades, going back to 1994, as well as the most recent North Beach CRA redevelopment planning process that did speak to utilization of the West Lots for the benefit of economic development and economic growth in North Beach. There are current uses at the West Lots that include the Ocean Rescue North Beach headquarters. There is a skate park. There is the Trap, Neuter, Vaccinate, Release, or the Kitty Campus facility. There are two lots that are vacant and unimproved. There are also municipal parking lots there. The site is also sometimes temporarily used as a staging area for film crews through a special event permit and or food distributions or testing sites for COVID in the recent past. So the West Lot Master Plan called for several uses of the West Lots. That plan was developed in 2018 by Dover Cole. There's also $5 million in seed funding through the General Obligation Bond, the 2018 GEO Bond, to facilitate improvements on the West Lots. The skate park project is a GEO Bond project that is slated to expand and improve the existing skate park, and there's a funding gap of about $2 million there. While the city administration is certainly open to all opportunities for the West Lots, we would recommend that the following be contemplated. So parking is essentially a major concern for North Beach. With the Ocean Terrace Public Improvement Project receiving its permit less than 2 weeks ago and pending groundbreaking soon, the city is required to provide construction parking as part of the city's agreement. We also anticipate that the 72nd Street complex, while it will provide for some limited additional parking, we anticipate that parking demand in the area that is associated with that project and potentially with other growth in the area would result in parking needs for North Beach. And we do not yet have a parking master plan that is underway, but that's something we need to consider. Also, a public-private partnership was considered for the West Lots. There were some preliminary discussions that happened just before COVID. The city did not have direction to move forward with an RFP. We were focused at the time on securing approval of the North Beach CRA. So a master planning process that might include recreation could result from internal efforts or through a public-private partnership or RFP process. And so we just wanted to give you sort of the framework and background of the West Lots, where we are today, what the current uses are, and what we consider to be important elements going forward.
So a couple of years ago, or maybe a year and a half ago, some time ago, I saw an idea that someone had of potentially expanding the park using the West Lots, and I don't know if that item, if it ever got any public airing or, but so I'm not going to be here much longer. But I'm not in favor of selling all those lots off for housing development. I love the idea of expanding the park and recreational activities, but I think it has to be a very deliberate and planned exercise because you go and put tennis courts in there or pickleball, and I guarantee you, you're never going to take them out, right? Because once they're there. Now, today I'm just hearing, it's not in the surprise category, so don't get worried, that on the skate park, so, and I don't know if Maria's here, but so do you know, John, that I heard there's a $2 million shortfall on the skate park. Is that where is that project? Is it ready to go but for the $2 million?
We did stop at midway through design or partway through design when the funding gap was recognized. And there are so many other priorities, not only for the city, but for the Parks Department, all these underfunded or unfunded projects. We pushed that out on the priority scale. So we're partially through design, but design's not complete.
All right. So, and do you need the $2 million for the design, or you need the $2 million for the entire project?
That's a projected total project.
Okay. All right. So I will meet with you privately before the budget meeting on the 27th to see if we need – Jason, can you look at that to see if we need – I don't know how much money you need to finish the design, if that's a $250,000. Anyway, Jason, look at that. I'll meet with you on the 27th and see if there's anything we need to do to move the project along. I might be able to find that a couple of million on the money tree. So we'll circle back before the 27th of September, which is when we will do our second budget adoption, okay? So I'll be back in touch. And, Jason, if you can look at that as well, okay? Commissioner, did you have something else? Go ahead.
Sure, Mr. Chair. Your thought about the possibility in the future of expanding the park to the west lots, I think it's something we should be perhaps might be a good idea to take out to the community, speak with them about. I personally feel that that it makes sense. I think it would add to the character of North Beach Oceanside Park and driving through Collins Avenue, being able to have the park on both sides.
On both sides. Wouldn't it be incredible?
Yeah.
I saw some preliminary designs. I don't remember exactly where, but I thought it was an amazing idea and really doubles the size of the park.
And maybe we can increase our tree canopy there as well.
Exactly.
Which North Beach desperately needs.
Right. Exactly. Okay, good.
My idea.
Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, the reason I put this on here, you know, and the way I phrased it was, you know, again, this is something 8 years ago I was working on. I tried to bring, if you guys remember, the old Wynwood Yard, which was very, very popular in Wynwood, and then that got sold to a private developer and they closed. And, you know, we did a lot of work and it's ready to go. And then, you know, your friend, Commissioner Fernandez, just tanked it for no other reason than it was my idea. And nothing's been done. In 8 years, you know, there's very little that's happened on the west lots. And so, you know, we have heard rumblings of private developers wanting to come in and do, you know, unsolicited proposals and things like that. And, you know, I personally don't think that building luxury housing there is the way to go. I don't think that's what we need. If somebody were to, you know, have a really great idea for affordable workforce housing, I'd listen to that. But I'm leaving in a month, and I know that you know, developers would love to get their hands on those lots. So what I want to talk to you guys about is what we just talked about, which is, you know, can we use this for, you know, active public space? I mean, right now they're just open lots, but they're not really, you know, groomed or prepared for, you know, children to play on. The lots themselves are, you know, full of rocks and debris, so it's not really safe for playing soccer and things like that. Do we want to think about making it either an extension of the park across the street or taking portions of it and turning it into formal soccer lots or things like that? I, for one, would very strongly like to see some of this dedicated for, you know, active public use, particularly for children.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
When we look at the recommendations of the Dover Call Master Plan, one of the 5 points that they recommended, one of them was a use that supports the adjacent passive park, North Beach Oceanside Park. I think what you're saying is consistent with that, and I think it's perhaps a good time to engage in a community-driven process of what an expansion of recreation and park uses could look like on those lots. I think it's like, what, 9 acres that we have there or something like that?
9.6.
I'm sorry?
9.6.
So almost 10 acres. I mean, that is so amazing that our residents were able to get that from the state's domain. And can you imagine how dangerous it would be if that would have stayed under the state's domain? We've seen in other jurisdictions where the state had property and then they sold it off to developers and they've gone and got in height and all that. I would like us to put these thoughts back into recreational and public uses, and maybe we can make a motion to the commission so that we can give direction to the administration to start in some sort of community engagement conversation as to what the future of these 10 acres, almost 10 acres, could be as recreational and park use.
I'm sorry, if you're making that motion,
I'll move that.
So, all right, so I will second that, and so we'll send back to the commission a recommendation that the commission direct the administration to begin a process of engagement with the local community about how to utilize that space more formally for recreation and park space.
Okay, thank you.
And perhaps the administration would start some charrettes, and then I could see how after that process we might issue invitations from people to, like, a private public to do that.
Would there be a request? I know that Raquel had mentioned there was a master plan on that. Would it make sense to perhaps have an update on what the outcome of that semi-recently completed master plan is?
Certainly, and any new public charrette process might require engagement of a consultant, potentially, and so if there is a fiscal impact, we would advise as such.
I'm just through the chair.
Go ahead.
Why do we need to hire a consultant to have town hall meetings to just engage, let's preliminarily, before we start spending money, which is resources, taxpayers' money. It's not our money. It's the taxpayers' money. Why can't we just have a few meetings? Start off, let's just see. Maybe we have a few meetings with North Beach residents, the immediate stakeholders, and maybe they don't like the idea. Mm-hmm. And so before we start rushing to hire consultants and enter into contracts, and then we can get out of the contracts, and then, we got the list of the 50 actions that the administration took and why we can't move back now, why don't we first pause a little bit, and before we rush to engage a consultant, let's speak with the people who we work for, the constituents, the residents, the taxpayers of Miami Beach, before we use their money to hire a consultant.
We can certainly do some community outreach. Once it turns into a public charrette process, that may be beyond our resources in-house. But, yes, so we can definitely do community
outreach. With all due
respect, yes.
Raquel, that's BS. I mean, we have so many employees in this city all making six figures with incredible resumes. To say it's beyond our resources, I know everyone's busy, but we have a lot of people with, I think a lot of talent. I don't buy that. To sit there and take notes from meetings and put them back out in a presentation, it's well within our capacity, and even doing master planning for something like the West Lots, we just dust off the multiple consultants and charrettes we've already done on this and just update them. I mean, it's within our capacity. Don't say that's not within our capacity.
Maybe we can amend the motion rather than to say charrette, because we don't want to give.
It's a fancy word, right? That costs money.
It costs. Maybe just community
meetings, outreach.
General, very broad.
Don't use the word charrette.
Yes.
Community outreach.
Yeah. Direction to engage with the community on the West Lots related to recreational and community uses?
Recreation and park. And specifically that no consultant is authorized to be engaged on the project.
For the time being. And maybe,
Down the road.
What comes out of the community.
Let's do some preliminary work and then get that back, and then let's see where we are. All right, guys, I got to move on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Raquel. We have a time certain on item 17, waste hauler. We've spent a lot of time on this, guys. There's one, maybe two issues that are open, which is why this got back here, and I have some ideas on how we can resolve it. Joe, you're recognized. It's my understanding the one issue on the RFP that we really need to focus on is the question of continuity of contracts, because you had none, and the industry would like something, and so I've said we're going to find a compromise. So tell us very briefly, and then I'm going to let my colleagues know what my idea is. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Joe Gomez, Public Works Director. I apologize for my voice. I'm losing a little bit of it. Commissioner, we've outlined our recommendations, and one of those obviously is the issue of the transition period. At this point, I'd like for Deputy City Attorney Rick DiPico to weigh in, since he crafted a lot of this language.
Okay. We have a draft RFP now, and I understand the draft says that all existing contracts will come to termination with the adoption of a new contract. Is that right?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and commissioners. The draft of the RFQ does currently reflect that the contracts will sunset when the new contract, when the new franchise agreement is taken to effect. In the memo, the administration has recommended a possible solution to the phasing out issue. And excuse me, I'm losing my voice a little bit too. The idea is that contracts that expire in 2024 would be phased out first, and then contracts that expire in 25 or later would be phased out during a second phase. So we would split it up into two phases.
Okay. So I didn't realize that there was a recommendation. Let me tell you what my idea is, because I've told the industry you can't have all your contracts just go forever, because somebody could go out tomorrow and just issue all new five-year contracts, right? So, and I'm not going to allow that to happen. So what I would propose is that any contract that is signed on or after January 1st of 23, those contracts would expire 60 days after a new franchise agreement. That way it's going to prevent anybody from running out and adding a lot of new contracts at 5 years. So any contract that is signed on or after January 1st of 23 expires 60 days after the new franchise. Then I would say anything in any contract signed in 22 can have a 3-year total life or less if that's what the contract says. And then any contract signed before January 1st of 22 can have their life of their contract. So because it's going to result in another probably 2 years or whatever, maybe after, because if it's a 5-year contract, two and a half, 3 years has already passed. So, gentlemen, that's what I would propose how we handle it. Are you guys okay with that? Go ahead. Okay. So the question before us really is, how do we handle existing contracts? So right now in the draft RFP, it's drafted that all contracts end. And first of all, we don't want to do that. It's very disruptive that all the contracts, that everybody would be renegotiating contract. So what my proposed solution is, and I've told everybody, I don't want to create a situation where everybody can go out and sign new contracts today for 5 years and basically avoid having this competitive process with an RFP. So I've said my proposal is any franchise contract signed January 1st of 23 or later expires 60 days after a new franchise agreement. That way we're going to prevent the industry from running out and signing up new contracts. Anything signed in 22 can have a 3-year total life or less if the contract was for less than that. And anything signed before January 1st of 22 can have their contract period. And that's kind of how I would solve it.
And I think that's good, because sometimes these contracts are long.
Right.
But if we put in here now, regardless of what the contract period states, they're going to expire 60 days after we award. Well, now that allows the consumer to be protected with some of the things like we've put that we've put here, like the terms of the contract, that they can't be longer than 2 years, and the no auto renewals and that type of stuff that right now does not exist, but that we're placing there for the protection of the consumer.
And what you're
proposing, I think we'll make sure that, let's say someone signed the contract for 5 years, you know, or for an extended period of time, now they can benefit from these protections sooner.
And the two-year thing is still in there with the smaller, the 9 to 24 units. Mm-hmm. They still, the maximum of a new contract can only be 2 years. Mm-hmm. That's still in there. So what I'm trying to avoid is a situation where the industry goes out today and signs everybody up for a five-year contract,
right?
And then wants to enjoy that five-year contract, which would really skirt our competitive process, because we're going to have at least three. Remember, we agreed to have at least three, so we have plenty of competition. So I think one of you will move that, so we've got to move that back to the commission, right?
So
it's unanimous. We'll send that back with that recommendation. Now, Joe, there was one other issue that someone told me that in the RFP, maybe, Rick, you can tell me that there's a potential for a five-year extension. Is that the way it's written?
Yes.
Okay. So what happens in that case? If somebody's in the middle of a contract, we extend. Can they continue the contract?
The intention now is that at the end of the 5 years, we would go back to zero and everybody starts again.
No, I don't like that either. I'll tell you why. It's so disruptive that we would have everybody's contract being renewed at the same time. I mean, it's...
Well, if the haulers prepare contracts so that they will expire on that date, then that would prevent the chaos potentially. And that is what the directive is in the RFQ.
Yeah, and I don't like that either. Okay. I think that's bad policy. Because you don't want everybody's contract ending at the same time. It's too disruptive. It puts too much burden on industry to have to redo everybody's contract at the same time. So what is the notice for the city to allow or to exercise the five-year option? Is it a 60-day notice, a 90 days, or what is it?
The city has not made a determination as to what that would be, but I suspect that the city typically provides 90-day notice in renewals.
We should put that in the RFP. That should be a requirement in the RFP to let people know. What's typical? Is it 90 days?
90 days.
Okay. So we should put that in the RFP, that the city will notify if the city wants to exercise the five-year. And is it the city's option or industry as well?
Well, the waste hauler could certainly decline to continue, but it's the city's option to renew.
Okay. Right. Yeah. So let's make it clear that if the city wants to exercise the option, they have to notify 90 days in advance that they're exercising the option. It gives everybody an opportunity.
And then what would you do with the contracts that are, I mean, for example?
They can, if somebody's in the middle of the contract and we exercise the option, then they get to continue the contract. There's no reason to reset everybody's contract.
Okay.
It's too disruptive.
And I had a point of clarification on the contracts that are entered into before January 1 of 2021. They are entitled to go through the life of the contract with
January 1st of 22. So any contract signed January 1st of 23 or later gets 60 days after the new franchise agreement.
Right.
And they come to a close. Any contract signed in 22. So that would be January 1st to December 31st.
So 3 years in length. And
they get 3 years. Anything before January 1st of 22 can live out their contract.
The clarification I seek is life of contract without options, correct?
Yes, life of contract without, no options.
Okay.
On that, that's a very good point. So if the contract had another five, no, it's just the original
term. The
original term of the contract, no extensions.
Thank you.
And, Commissioner, this is just for the existing franchisees' contracts if that franchisee is awarded a new contract. Otherwise, if you're not awarded
your contract
expires at the expiration of the franchise.
Yeah, right.
One other point of clarification. For contracts that pertain to the 9 to 24 that we are now limiting to 2 years, does that impact this structure in any way? In other words, if...
No, because those are new contracts.
So if you have a 9 to 24 currently that has another 3 years left, you ride that out, and then that's when...
Right.
Okay, the two-year term would start.
Exactly. Eric, did I mess this up?
No. I just wanted to get one more clarification, if I could.
Sure.
So we're moving with the RFQ with a provision that was based on a recommendation from the commission that we not have evergreen clauses in the contracts. If there's an existing contract that gets to run out its term because it was executed prior to 22 and it's an evergreen contract, how do we handle – I would just like to get some clarity on that.
Tell me what – I don't know what you mean by evergreen, that it never sunsets?
Never sunsets.
No.
So maybe defer to legal counsel. How do we get out of
it? No, I believe that you just answered that maybe in a – I posed the question in a different manner. I mentioned options, and you said no options. If it has an evergreen clause, the end of the first term is it.
Yeah, but if an evergreen doesn't have a termination date at all.
Right.
Well, evergreens are – there's a term, and then it renews for another term. So it would have a termination.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say normally evergreen clauses, they renew automatically. What we just do is put a cleave in it. Cleave. Just, you know, before it renews automatically, we say we're not going to renew.
Correct.
And then we start the negotiations again.
Or maybe RFQ.
So I would say to add to that, just to make sure that there's not one contract out there that doesn't have a termination date, you could say, and no contract can extend for a period of more than five years.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you.
So if you're in 22, by the time this gets awarded, it's going to be 24. They would leave about 2.5 or 3 years maybe on it.
Correct.
Because there may be one contract out there that doesn't have any termination date on it. Okay, you got what you need?
Yes, sir.
I just want to make sure.
Yeah, go ahead.
We're still requiring for the hauler, notwithstanding these evergreen clauses and all that, to provide the 90-day notice to the consumer.
Yes.
And the consumer is still going to have 60 days.
Yes.
To respond to that, which is something new that we're doing that we didn't have before.
That's part of the language in the yard.
And the only difference in the recommendation is that if the customer does not respond, rather than convert the contract to just a month-to-month, then it does renew for one year.
1 year. Correct.
1 year. Okay. All right.
And the other thing I just want to make sure is we had some provision. I think the commission left it where if somebody wants a T4C, they can request that. So the offer, the franchisee could give them either option, right?
Yes. It's an option with the understanding that that option would probably be more costly.
Yeah, of course it's going to be more costly, and that's how we handle a T4C.
That's the termination for convenience.
Yes.
Right. That right now we don't have, but it's like, what is it? It's a proposed 30-day termination.
Days. Yes, sir.
With so a 30-day notice from the consumer.
30 days termination.
So if somebody wants that in their contract, the franchise, they have to offer it.
Right.
They can price it differently.
Right.
But they can offer it.
It's like a cell phone. Is someone can choose to do a monthly plan or yearly plan. There's a difference in price, just to put it in very layman's term. Okay.
All right, we got what we need, guys.
So environmental issue of the trucks. Will the city have the right to inspect the trucks for cleanliness, for leaking, to make sure that they're up to the standards that they should be?
That's a current provision that we have in our current contracts, and that it's continued on into the new RFQ process, that we will have the right to inspect our vehicles at any time, and then if we find that the vehicle is defective, they have to cure it by bringing in a new vehicle within 2 hours to address the issue.
And are we establishing a maximum amount of years in which a vehicle can be? I'm sorry?
3 years.
3 years.
3 years.
3 years.
We don't want any equipment that's older than 3 years.
Okay. All right. Good.
So that, I know that, was that changed? Because I know that issue was very controversial. And I thought that that had been tweaked a little bit from... I'm not taking any public comment, so I'm just we've had a lot of public comment, and so we're not doing that today. I don't have the time. Eric.
So, committee members, chair, this particular item, we had originally talked about having a new fleet when they start the new franchise agreement. We got a lot of pushback from, obviously, our waste hauling partners, And so where we compromised were we were willing to go with vehicles that were no more than 3 years old at time of beginning the franchise agreement. That franchise agreement is a five-year agreement and potentially a five-year extension. We don't think those vehicles are going to last 13 years, but could potentially end up with 13-year-old vehicles if you start at three. We don't want to start at five or eight as they had proposed. You know, we're open to discussing other reasonable alternatives, but 3 years at the beginning of service we think is reasonable.
Okay. So why don't I ask you all to, again, have another conversation with industry, let them give you any input on that particular issue. And you're going to bring this back on, I think it's coming back on the 27th.
Yes, sir.
Right?
Correct.
Okay. So go ahead and start. That's the only issue that I really need you to have another and see if you're comfortable. I know that it was tweaked from what you originally had, I think, a little bit, and I think we're comfortable. Yeah. But go ahead and have that conversation, okay?
And ultimately, the most important thing is the inspection. Because even if a vehicle is more than 3 years old, it may be in better conditions when you inspect it than a newer vehicle. So the most important for me, the most important thing to see here is the control of us being able to have the right to inspect these vehicles at any time. Because a vehicle that's new, that's been in service for a year, but you've been using it left and right and all over the place, and the wear and tear on that vehicle could be greater and cause more environmental damage than an older vehicle that has fewer miles, fuel use on it, fewer wear and tear. So the inspection requirement is truly a control that I want to see there in place.
That's in the RFQ now.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And are we specific about time and place of inspection, or is it?
Yes, it's basically at our discretion. At any time, we can request to inspect the vehicle at any given time, and if we find the vehicle to be defective, they have to cure. They have up to 2 hours to provide us another vehicle.
Okay.
To address the issue.
Yeah, that I agree with you, Commissioner. That is the more important piece.
The inspection.
If the truck's a little bit older, you know, I don't care as much as if we're inspecting. So anyway, you all have that conversation with the industry. That is the only issue that you really need to engage and have one more conversation on. And then we'll see you back at the commission with this recommendation on the 27th of September.
Yes.
You got it? You got what you need?
I believe so. I'll be working with Joe.
And I apologize if anyone's here to speak, but we've had a lot of public hearing on this, and I have an hour and 5 minutes to finish about 15 items. So with that, we'll close this item.
Point of order, Mr. Chairman?
No, there's no point of order. We're not taking public comment. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Absolutely. I want to call up item 15 on the mooring field, an update on this. And then we've got a time certain at 10 o'clock. So who's here on item 15? We've been talking about this mooring field forever, haven't we?
Yeah. Yeah, you want to give us an update? Because I thought we had sort of resolved things for the time being, but go ahead and then I'll
You're
chime
recognized.
In.
Tell us about the mooring field.
Sure. Well, good morning, Chair, good morning. Vice Chair, and Commissioners. Amy Knowles, Chief Resilience Officer. The mooring field project is underway, and in addition, a resolution was adopted in June by the Commission in regards to the anchor limitation areas. The city did engage our consultant for the mooring field in August to do the design and permitting, which is that first phase. We had our kickoff meeting. We've conducted field work in terms of looking at the seagrass surveys, the benthic surveys, hydrographic surveys, and submerged debris. And so once these are completed and the reports are done, then the consultant will do some refined concepts in terms of the layout, where the mooring field more closely can go. So right now, CIP is beginning to lead the project with support from Environment Sustainability. And, you know, there will be meetings with the environmental regulatory agencies. There will be lots of public engagement. A management plan has to be developed, ordinance development. All of this will need to be done over the next couple of years. So we expect to have permitting done within the next couple of years is the timeline. So that's the mooring field update.
And Commissioner, just to follow up, if I may, on Commissioner Arriola's comment, the commission did resolve this issue temporarily. You sponsored, Commissioner Arriola, an item that the design and permitting will continue, but we would not commence construction unless an anchor limitation area would be established by either the state or the county to protect the issue of the boats, you know, moving over and shifting to other areas.
Yeah, and I remember we were very, very specific on that. So, and Commissioner, I want to recognize you, but I'm worried that we're spending a lot of money and that issue's never going to get resolved. And then we spend all the money and then we don't move forward, because we've been very clear that we're not going to move forward if that issue doesn't get resolved. So, Commissioner Arriola.
Thank you for that. So this legislative session, which, you know, it's going to start pretty soon, this has to be one of our legislative priorities going into the new session. Hopefully we can get it resolved this year so that we have clarity moving forward with our mooring fields. If we can't get it done this year, then it's just going to keep waiting and waiting. So it's got to be one of our top priorities to work with the legislature to find a happy medium and satisfy their concerns.
And to that point, I've spent a little time in Tallahassee. I think there is zero appetite in Tallahassee right now to touch this issue, to help create new no anchor or stay away zones or whatever you want to call them. But we'll see. Commissioner Fernandez. I'm sorry? Because the boating industry and lobby in this state is incredibly powerful. That's the blunt answer.
Yeah, and if you remember our conversation, recognizing that, and I'm a boater myself, we have a plan where, you know, we're going to approach them and address their concerns, right? So that this is helping the boating industry, which is basically creating a mooring field that's going to be very inexpensive and accessible for boaters, right? So that we're not making our waterways exclusive to Miami Beach residents or exclusive to just people who can afford to moor here, but basically encouraging boating and safe boating, protecting the environment while also respecting individual homeowners, you know, privacy rights. So right. I think it's all in who we're using to approach the legislature and what the message is. I think well done, we could have some success here. But we'll see.
And right now there's a provision where the county can do these no anchor zones, right?
Yes, Commissioner. And we do have this item on our state agenda. Our lobbyists are aware that it is a significant priority for our city.
Great.
And I've spoken with Marcia about it and Kelly, and so there's definitely movement and the intent there.
Is there any engagement with the county, though?
Yes.
Because the county now has the authority to do these no anchor, and so has there been any dialogue with the county on designating any areas?
Yes, Commissioner. So the county passed, you know, an item last year, directing staff to develop a process to create anchoring limitation areas because they don't currently have one. This was something kind of new. So the county staff has been working on it. We've had several meetings with them to clarify, you know, our issues and concerns and the need for anchor limitation areas in Miami Beach. They still have not yet brought a report back to BCC. They're still working on that. We also forwarded them the resolution that was recently passed, you know, from our commission in June, and that was very specific about the areas that we would, you know, like to pursue the anchor limitation areas. So all of that is in process. They're aware. They are focusing on areas that have known to have a high level of derelict vehicles across the county, so they're looking at this holistically.
So you're saying the county's still working on their procedures, their process?
Yeah, that's correct.
Do they have an estimated date on when they're going to finish that?
I don't believe at this time. They're still working on it. The report was due this summer to the BCC.
It was due this past summer?
Yes.
So do we have a copy of the report?
They're not finished with it yet.
But you said it was due this summer.
Yes, yeah.
But they didn't meet their due date?
Perhaps they had some sort of extension worked out. But, the resolution that was passed by the Board of Commissioners, you know, last summer asked for the report within a year.
It happens at the county.
No.
Mr. Chair.
Please.
I just have a question for Amy. Does the state statute establish any benchmarks that the county has to meet in order for the establishment of the ALAs? I get, for example, I know that the statute says that I believe they can only designate like up to 10% of the county waterways as an anchorage limitation area. But to establish that anchorage limitation area, do they say you need to check these boxes in order to do that? Or is that completely up to the jurisdiction of the county what that process looks like?
Yes, there are a few items spelled out in the state statute, but I do want to clarify that the county anchoring limitation area is different than a state-designated anchoring limitation areas. You know, then in the state statute, the currently adopted areas that were grandfathered in basically prohibit overnight mooring. So that is something that is of great interest to our residents. Mm-hmm. And the county anchoring limitation areas, while they can establish them, they are not allowed to prohibit overnight mooring. The rules are a little bit different. They're allowed to do things like a person may not anchor a vessel for more than 45 consecutive days in a six-month period. So there are it is a little bit different between the state and the county, and it's something that, you know, we've discussed at committee before. So both of them, you know, will help with a well-managed waterway, but they are a little bit different. But to answer your question directly, the county may not exceed 10% of the county's designated delineated navigable, in fact, waterways. They have to be less than 100 acres in size. They don't include a mooring field or a marina. They have to be clearly marked with signage.
Okay. So yeah, that's a basic criteria they have to fit into.
Yeah, and the state areas are very limited, and I think took about 5 years to get passed. And so, Amy, why don't you reach out? Commissioner Ariel, this is your item, but I want to bring this back for 5 minutes in on October 16th. Can you reach out to the county and find out exactly where they are with this report? Because it seems it's taken over a year for them just to write their procedures and, can you reach out and find out where they are?
We'd be happy to. And if you'd like, we could also invite them.
Yeah,
to the
invite
committee.
Them in to tell us where they're at. That would be great.
Okay, great.
October. And if you want, we'll give them a time certain so they know exactly when to be here. October 16th, we'll be starting the meeting. Just tell them they can come at 10:30. We'll give them a time certain.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Jason, you got what you need?
Yes, we'll show the update was provided on the mooring field project. Noted.
Is that okay with you, Commissioner? Your item?
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, and then we've got a time certain at 10 a.m. on item 18 for the football playoff national championship game. So you're going to tell us what this is and what your dreams are. Lisette, you're recognized. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. Lisette Garcia-Rogante, Director of Tourism and Culture, City of Miami Beach. The South Florida College Football Playoff National Championship Game Host Committee has been awarded the 2026 CFP National Championship. So for your consideration today, they're asking a request of city special event sponsorship, and I'm going to detail those now. A cash sponsorship in amount of $500,000 for events held in Miami Beach during the college playoff. A sponsorship of city services not to exceed $300,000. A waiver of special event fees not to exceed $250,000, and a rental waiver of the Miami Beach Convention Center in the amount of $850,000, bringing the total ask to $1.9 million in a combination of cash sponsorship, special event fees, and rental costs waivers. In addition to that, the sponsorship benefits include a $30,000 investment at a Miami Beach Elementary School in 2025, through an initiative with Miami-Dade County Public Schools. The Extra Yard for Teachers Summit will be held in Miami Beach. A 25% discount for Miami Beach residents on entry fees that are for events that are made available on for sale in Miami Beach. 25% discount to Miami Beach residents to the Taste of the Championship event at the Convention Center. 25% discount to Miami Beach residents on entry fees to the Extra Yard 5K race. City of Miami Beach will be recognized on a host committee produced collateral, social, digital, as well as Their headquarter hotels will be the Lowe's South Beach and the Fontainebleau. In addition to that, the ESPN broadcast command will be in Loomis Park. So while the game is at Hard Rock, all the beauty shots, Sports Center will be live. It'll be in our beautiful Loomis Park and with our beach landscape. And today we have representatives from the host committee, which are COO Ana Hernandez Ochoa and Vice President John Moss, who are here to answer any further questions.
Okay. Come on up. But before we do that, I'm going to let you present in just a minute. I'm curious about the history on this. I don't know, Lissette, if you have that, I know,
sure.
Or if Eric can, but we provided sponsorship in the past. Was that 3, 4, 5 years ago?
Yes, for 2021, the cash sponsorship was around $400,000. And in addition, it did have the waiver of the convention center. However, due to COVID, they actually did not end up using the convention center, but they did. It was approved for the waiver, the rental waiver, plus the city services and everything else.
And the $850 that you mentioned, the request for the rental waiver, I don't know what our normal rental fee is. It seemed like a big number, but is that
That's average.
Okay.
It's not a big number.
All right, good. Why don't I let you guys come on up and spend 5 minutes and tell us what your dreams are.
So I'll start off. Good morning.
Yourself. Yeah, good,
yeah,
good
morning. I'm John. I'm with the Orange Bowl Committee and the host committee, Vice President of Partnerships there. Just to kind of answer your question about the overview, I'll give you the overview of college football. When I started 20 years ago at the Orange Bowl, we were a part of the Bowl Championship Series. And in a 12-year contract, we were afforded the opportunity to host a championship game every 4 years. And in those non-championship years, we hosted a regular Orange Bowl game. You know, in 2014, 2015, the entity, the governing body, changed to the College Football Playoff, and they wanted to create a playoff system where more teams had the opportunity to play for a championship game. They created that and narrowed it down to 4 teams. With that said, they also added 2 more bowl games to the rotation. So now, instead of 4, there was a total of 6. A 6, we rotate the semifinal every 3 years, and then those non-semifinals, we have an Orange Bowl game. The important key there, and their goal was for a national championship game, a community, a city had to come together to bid for it, very much like the NFL does for the Super Bowl. And their goal, their end-all goal, was to have a different city in a 12-year cycle to host a championship game. As you had mentioned, back in 2017, we actually won the bid for the 2021 game. As we know, March of 2020 came, COVID hits. And I will tell you, it was a struggle. And we actually got the game off. We had 20% attendance per COVID restrictions at the stadium. We had Ohio State versus Alabama, which I will tell you, in a traditional year, there's not enough folding chairs in the country to host that. That's a mega matchup. But we got the game off, and immediately following the game, we went back to the governing body and said, listen, our community didn't get the full breadth of what a championship game should look like. And we placed a bid, and we are actually one of the cities that will be hosting in this 12-year span for a second time. And we won that bid in 2026. There is one other entity, Atlanta, will be getting it for a second time. And the reason they got it in 2025 is Las Vegas was really supposed to get it. They did not have enough hotel rooms to accommodate because of a big convention that's going on there. So, and then just in general, the way of college football has changed. The way we consume entertainment has changed, streaming and phone. I would tell you the last national championship game in 2022 peaked at 25.4 million viewers on ESPN, making it a top event in cable history since the last 2020 national championship game. And it was the most non-NFL sporting event during the span of the any network as far as ratings like that are concerned. So I'll let Anna talk a little bit about our bid process.
Okay. You got like 2 minutes.
No, I'll do it very quick.
Thank you so much. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. So we did go through a bid process, and last August, I believe, we were awarded the 2026 game, which will take place on January 19th of 2026. And it's a great event for our city, for everyone. We do expect there to be in excess of $265 million in economic output, over $100 million in media exposure throughout the weekend. In terms of hotels, obviously what it brings in tourism is grand. We do have 2 confirmed hotels in the city of Miami Beach. Their headquarter hotels, one team hotel will be the Fontainebleau, and the other will be the Lowe's Miami Beach. terms of the ESPN compound, I think it was mentioned earlier, they will be broadcasting from Loomis the entire weekend, so it'll be a huge infomercial for the city of Miami Beach. And in addition to that, there are two events that have already been confirmed to take place here over the weekend. Playoff Fan Central, which is very similar to like an NFL experience type event happening here at the Convention Center. In addition to Playoff Playlist Live, which is a series of concerts over the weekend at Loomis Park. A couple other events that we do expect will come here, just based on what we've seen in other cities, would be the Extra Yard 5K, the Taste of the Championship, the Extra Yard for Teacher Summit. And again, those are events that, just bring a lot of fanfare over the weekend.
Okay, great. Thanks so much. Guys, you like this? Okay, yeah. So my only question, I have two questions. $500,000 in cash, and that is for 26. So that's we're funding that in the future. Is that right?
I defer to our CFO.
Jason, you got that? What do you have a recommendation? I know there was some thought of trying to earmark some money, but what is there a recommendation?
I think there's interest in bringing it back as a resolution, in October, endorsing the package to get that done as a resolution as it comes from the funding perspective. We do have the large-scale community events funding, which is new, so there's a pool available for that, and it may be, obviously, it's the recommendation of the FERC, but it may be, because that's a big number, that $500,000, to maybe split that over multiple years. The cash would not be paid out until FY26, but we could go ahead and encumber that via resolution, perhaps at 100, 200, 200 over 3 years to spread that out. But that's just an option. And
yes, and the other question I have is the VCB. Are you also applying for any money from them?
Do you know? The GNCVB, believe that.
No, not that. Is it the VCB that has funding?
The VCA.
I'm sorry?
VCA.
No, the Miami Beach VCA, yes.
No, I'm thinking of what's the group that has the $1.1 million for heads and beds? No, is that the Greater Miami?
GMCVB.
Yeah, that is.
GMCVB.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so the Greater Miami Visitors and Convention Bureau,
That's not considered a double dip, is it? Like, if they get money from them, it's still okay for us to... Because I'm trying to think of the issue that came up before where it's the VCA or the...
A lot of our events do get funding and different support from the GMCVB, from the Miami Beach VCA, especially at this scale.
Yeah, I don't consider that to be a double dip on that. But all right, so then the question is, sounds like we're unanimous that we want to recommend this. And then the question is, to Jason's point, do I want to burden you, Commissioner Fernandez, as a future commission to have all $500,000 in 1 year, or do we want to recommend earmarking $100,000, $200,000, and $200,000 so we split it up a little bit?
I think the tiered approach is what makes sense for us to do that expression of support now so that they know that the city of Miami Beach is interested in having this event return. I'm all for giving that expression of support and putting the funding through multiple fiscal years so it's not a one-time hit that we have to program for in the future. And I'll tell you, remember when this came in 2021, the value in terms of media exposure was so incredible. It was just like 24/7, whichever network you would flip your channel to. You would see the backdrop of Ocean Drive and the Art Deco district, and that is just invaluable impressions for us. In addition to, the city felt great. There was such good energy in the city, notwithstanding the fact that it was kind of like in the COVID time, but just the energy of the people that were coming, it was really spectacular. So I think this is a great investment.
I do too. And so we'll send it to... the October meeting.
The October commission meeting.
And so, because I'm really going to ask all my colleagues not to bring additional funding changes on September 27th, please. So I don't want to see this because I want to get the budget closed out and then in October. But I And you've got a recommendation that we accept the
approval package of the sponsorship at $500,000. Yeah. A cash contribution would be funded $100,000 in 2024 and $200,000 in 2025 and in 2026.
Yeah, that way we don't burden any particular year, but no funds are released until
in payment of cash is until FY 2026.
Yeah,
what would be great in that item? Let's include in that item, please, for example, because this is not just about Miami Beach. This is about the region, about Miami-Dade County. Miami-Dade County benefits from this. So does the city of Miami. And it would be great to include there to show what is Miami-Dade County contributing? What is the city of Miami contributing? Because they also have events that are going on in their cities for this. And what is the Bureau contributing?
Yeah, I know they are. You already have a commitment from the county. Is that right? Or you're working on it?
We're working on the commitment from the county and the city of Miami. We have a commitment from the Florida Sports Foundation and their Greater Miami CVB.
How much are you getting from the Florida Sports Foundation? Do you know?
1.5.
Okay, that's great. All right. Well, maybe work with staff to and put in your memo when you bring this on October 18th with a favorable recommendation, unanimous. Okay.
Thank you very much.
You got
much.
Everything you need, Jason?
Yes, so the administration will also endeavor to include in the memo a list of other jurisdictions and what their sponsorship levels are.
Yep.
That are known. Okay, thank you.
That are known. And if they're not known, you can just put what you're requesting. Okay, this is great. I'm excited about
thank
this
you.
For 26. Thank you so much for coming. Okay, I want to call up item 19 on the Deco Bike. This is – good morning, Monica. How's Monica in the parking department? Great.
Good morning, Vice Mayor, good Commissioners. Morning.
Thank you. What do we got here?
The Deco Bike / City Bike contract was set to expire September 30th of this year. An amendment was made – approved by the commission, and the contract was extended on a month-to-month for up to 14 months next year, December. The purpose of that was to make it coterminous with the city of Miami and promote interoperability and also to protect the valuable Citibank sponsorship. This is on a month-to-month. So, in keeping with our normal processes, we are ready to issue an RFP for this contract. An RFP process could take, 4 to 6 months, et cetera. Because we are on a month-to-month, that's possible. However, Deco Bike has approached the city and gentlemen with an alternative, and I'm here to give you any information you need. I can give you as background that when this contract started back in 2009, this contract required extensive capital investment. And within the first 3 years or so, it became evident that they could not recover and become profitable with the existing terms. The city then turned around, extended the contract for 10 years, and during that time, all the terms that were committed to were met, and we are profitable. So here to answer any questions you may have.
When we say we are profitable, I mean the entity is profitable, and then we're getting a revenue stream, right? We get
correct.
Some payment.
Correct.
Yeah. And what do you remember what it was last year?
Sure. So our revenue, let me just give you some stats. In 2012, our revenue was $279,457. For this year, if we add a windfall, which was a provision of the contract, it's $1.4 million. And without the windfall, it's $718,000 revenue to the city.
Okay. And the contract, remind me, I thought we extended the term to be coterminous with the city of Miami, would, I think, was December 31st of 24. Is that
correct?
So their contract will now go through the end of 24.
Well, it was on a month-to-month.
Okay.
So it was whichever was first, an RFP process or the date of 24.
Okay.
December 31st.
And I am assuming you're with Deco Bike?
Yes. Good morning, Commissioners. Colby Reese with Deco Bike.
Okay. Go ahead and tell us your dream.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here, and we want to extend a big thank you to the city in general for the amazing support that everybody has provided over the years to make it a very successful program. If possible, could you bring up the short PowerPoint that I have? Excellent. Thank you very much.
And just for planning purposes, you got 6 or 7 minutes.
I think I'm dialed in. Appreciate it. Thank you for the time. So to give a little bit of background information on the program, when the original RFP came out in 2008, at that time, there was no bike share programs basically in North America. It was something that had just sort of blossomed in Europe right around that time. So when we originally went through the process, the contracting process, negotiations with the city, 2008, 2009, there was no template to look to. There was no such thing as a privately funded citywide bike share system. It just basically didn't exist. So there was a ton of unknowns. We competed against two other bidders, so there was three bids submitted. Deco Bike was the only one that was willing to fund the multi-million dollar cost to start up. The other two bidders asked the city to pay for everything. We opened the program in 2011, and it opened as the first citywide bike share system in the country, also the first privately funded program in the country, and it was successful from day one. Since 2011, the industry has evolved a lot, and programs have began to launch around the country and around the world. Some of the lessons that we've learned along the way is that some of the things that we agreed to in 2009 as a part of the contract process don't make sense now that we have a decade of track record behind us and the industry as well. We relaunched as City Bike in January of 2015. And since then, there's a lot of well-established facts relating to bike share programs. For us, we learned that it takes about a decade just to recoup the capital investment to start the programs in the first place. It's also very rare for a municipality to have a 100% privately funded program that's also financially sustainable. It's incredibly rare. There's really only one other city in the country that has that sort of format, and that's the City Bike program in New York City. Most bike share programs don't even bring in enough cash to pay for their operations costs, called fare box recovery. It's actually quite rare. We're fortunate to be one of those programs that does. Of course, the program provides a significant improvement in mobility for the residents and the visitors, and the relationship between Deco Bike and the city is one of the most successful public-private partnerships in the transportation sector, or public transportation sector. While most others lose money and require taxpayer subsidy. So to just give you an update on where the program is, we really have amazing stats. It's one of the most used programs per capita in the country. The system here has logged 16 million rides to date with a resident base of under 100,000 people. And we have the highest average stations per square mile, about 15 stations per square mile, making it incredibly convenient. That is several times greater than basically even the next big program, small program. It's an incredible stat. Bike to resident ratio, we have one bike per 100 residents, which is also, again, one of the best stats in the country. And the bikes are heavily used. They go out roughly 5 times a day each on average across the whole fleet, which is substantial. We're here to request a 5-year extension, and some of the rationale for that extension request is that the current system is achieving all goals and surpassing all goals, both ridership-wise and financial. There's no risk to taxpayers. We're not here to ask for any money. And also important is the cost to implement a new dock-based program if it were to go to bid without some necessity to do that. There would be a substantial loss and waste in terms of the valuable equipment and infrastructure that we have on the ground. Incredible amount of resources and years of effort, both from from our team, but also from your team as well. There has been a lot of time and effort put into making this a great program on both sides. There's also big risks with starting a new program, such as a lack of sponsors and lack of startup funding or financing for whoever may come in and bid for that project. Supply chain issues, unproven equipment, those are all things that are reality in this industry. Keeping the program growing provides continuous access, so there's no gap in service for the public, and it's a continuous revenue stream for the city as well. Other cities that have launched around the same time are also continuing to extend, such as in New York, Chicago. They're going to much longer contract periods after initial 10 years. And the reality is that DecoBike provides the city with really the most favorable revenue-sharing terms and percentages in the country. They are above and beyond any other program that's out there. And even cities that use public funds to start their programs and might have a private operator managing it for them, they don't have the same kind of terms either, simply because a lot of the programs don't generate enough revenue or surplus to be able to share. The program is zero cost to Miami Beach, positive cash flow to the city. DecoBike covers all theft, loss, and vandalism expenses, which post-COVID, bike theft has increased, vandalism has increased substantially. And when we installed the new city bike system in 2015, there was no corresponding contract extension for that. The extension that was done was a couple years prior to that. So we did put a brand new system in as well for the second time. So we've installed two full systems here. We've got Miami Beach covered. I think the map speaks for itself. We have a really, truly equitable station network. We didn't just set up stations in areas where it made sense for tourists who pay a higher price than residents. The residents enjoy a discounted membership where the residents kind of the visitors sort of subsidized that to keep that price low. We're in pretty much every neighborhood and pretty convenient for just about everybody in the city. Our history of investment and reinvestment into the program. So as I mentioned, two full bike share systems have been installed here. It's millions of dollars. We've spent millions in ongoing bike fleet replacement and parts replacement to keep the fleet rolling. Approximately $5 million will have been spent by the year end this year. We're receiving another 500 new bikes in December. We've added some new technologies, including some AI software enhancements to help with the rebalancing process. We added electric assist bikes as a part of the pilot program. We didn't raise the prices for that. It's the only program I'm aware of in the country where you can get an e-bike for the same price as a regular bike in terms of a rental, and residents don't pay anything extra. And as a part of the 5-year contract extension request, we're willing to spend at least another $2 million for new additional bikes and e-bikes. And if there's some locations that the city would like to see additional docking stations, we also have that equipment ready to go. And just a little background on, you know, how capital intense.
You need to wrap it up, okay.
I'm sorry, how capital intense it is. It's millions of dollars in staffing, incredible insurance premiums and liability. It's a 24-hour business operating for many years. Bike share stations are public infrastructure. Ours are permanently installed. We've had to excavate roadways over asphalt, put in concrete footers and engineering. So they are permanently installed due to hurricane code. The systems are meant to last 15 years or more. They can be serviced. They're not meant to be thrown away. Lastly, I just want to touch on how important it is that we have a committed title sponsor. Citibank has been an incredible partner both for us and for the city. Major title sponsors aren't common. There's really only a few like it, and we're fortunate to have that. That eliminates us asking the city for subsidies if there's a shortfall and whatever it might be because the operations are expensive or there's a pandemic. And even during the pandemic, Citibank went ahead and continued to pay, which saved our system from closure.
Casey, you're well over your 6 or 7,
I'm sorry.
Wrap it up.
That's pretty much it, and we request that.
Okay, so the request is 5 years from when? Today or 5 years from the end of this year? What's the request?
I was assuming that would be 5 years from the end of the current extension that we're operating in right now.
The end of this year. But that's a month. But let me ask a question because you say it's no cost to the city. Monica, we gave up parking places, right? What is the value of the parking places that have been dedicated to the – have you calculated that?
Yes, sir. So the at the time of the contract, it was estimated at $3,000 per space at 90 spaces. So we recoup that and make more.
So we're – because of the revenue stream we're getting back, it exceeds what we would get if those parking spaces were cars were on them, right?
Correct.
Okay. And is the 700,000 is there a minimum in the contract now? I don't know. Both of you can address this. Is there a minimum revenue stream to the city, or is it based on some calculation of net profit?
It's based on gross sales from starting at $0. There's not a minimum guarantee, but for every dollar that comes in, the city's guaranteed a chunk of that, between 12% and 25% of gross.
Of gross, because I thought that, Monica, when we talked, that expenses were deducted. So is
correct.
Is the fee based on gross revenue or net profit?
So it's gross minus a certain allowable expenses. And so it's kind of complicated, and like I said.
Kind of?
Well, you know, we like to have contracts that are easy to audit, right? Uh-huh. Rather than me having to try to verify that these expenses are how much salaries, et cetera. So what we were proposing for the new contract, for the new RFP, was a minimum guarantee that would be, at a minimum, a recovery of the parking spaces that are allowed for the operation, as well as a little more, and then a percentage. Currently, we are at a percent, 12, I believe, under 3 million, and 15 over, plus the 25% from the sponsorship.
What would happen in the situation where, if your sponsor went away, would that make you unprofitable, and then the revenue stream to the city would stop?
No. I mean, the revenue stream would continue because ridership does make up the majority of the revenue, even though we do have the sponsorship. The sponsorship is a safety zone. I would call it a safety net for the program. And when we – before we had the Citibank sponsorship, we were doing an advertising program, which was more of a 30, 60, 90-day campaign on the bike share kiosks and sometimes on the bikes. So the best – we have really the best thing available, which is a long-term sponsorship with Citi versus having to kind of rough it and try and sell 60-day ad slots like that. Most bike share programs are shooting for sponsorship like that.
I want to recognize my colleagues. So if you were to get an extension, would you agree to a guarantee?
Yeah, I think it's as long as it's reasonable and allows some flexibility, I think that's possible. We need to be careful in the event that there's a pandemic or something like that, because we were forced to close for half a year, and we were very fortunate to still be in business. And that was really thanks to our sponsor.
Yeah, so I think in that pandemic year, it dropped down to, what, $200,000 or $300,000 that we got in a revenue stream. Is that right, Monica? I think I saw that.
Correct.
Yeah. Guys, what do you think about this?
I personally think if it's not broken, why fix it? It's one of those services that, you know, in our city we hear so many complaints about so many different things. And this is the one service that we provide that our residents never complain about. And if anything, they celebrate and they enjoy. What I would like to see is, how do we actually get more residents on these bicycles for that cross-jurisdictional ridership that we aim to achieve? I think the moment a resident sits on one of those bicycles, sees how convenient the docking stations are, they'll continue using it. And so we kind of have to give sometimes I think our residents, you know, the carrot as to why to even test this for the first time. The residents that are using it now absolutely love it. But I think we have a big segment of our population that has not tried it yet. And as part of an extension, I'm wondering, would you be open to the idea of maybe having
a certain amount of a handful of times residents can use it at no cost a month, you know, so that we can get residents on it, they can get hooked on it, and then they can go ahead and establish their membership and continue with the program.
Yeah, I think that's a good question. It's a little challenging to make the service free. Even in other cities where they're 100% publicly funded, publicly subsidized, there's no free rides. What we do have is a very affordable monthly membership program, or someone could try it for a half an hour for a few dollars. I don't think there's a barrier to entry. I don't see it like that. Monthly membership for unlimited rides for a resident is $20. It was $15 for about the first 10 years. We never even raised rates. We haven't even kept up with inflation with that. So it really is a discounted rate. It's 67 cents a day for as many trips a day as you'd like to take. The first half hour is free. It gets you from point A to point B. Maybe there's a way we can work with the city that the city is a part of, you know, a credit towards some of the revenue share might be able to be used for, you know, doing something like that promotionally. We'd be open to that conversation.
I like that. At the end of the day, transportation is a service, and transportation, you know, doesn't necessarily have to be a revenue-generating venture. It is great that it is revenue-generating, but I think as a public service that we do provide, and this is a public service, Monica, I'd like for us to see how we can get, you know, a handful of opportunities that our residents can use it for free a month. I think that's a value added for our community. But I got to say, I've always been impressed with this program. I want to see it continue growing. I remember when it started as Deco Bikes. And I think, if anything, also the parking spaces that it utilizes, as you well mentioned, not only do we recover that cost, but I also think how many parking spaces are not being used. You know, how much capacity are we creating in our parking supply by getting individuals on these bicycles, which is, again, why I want to go back to the point. I think probably a lot of the people using this now are people who come here as to our community as a destination, so they enjoy it that way. But we'll save so much more parking if we get more of our residents on it. And the ones that have gotten on it absolutely love it. And so let's continue on this path. Please, the two parties negotiate, see how we can create some sort of program like that if the body agrees, or our residents maybe have two or three times a month that they can use it for free.
I'd also like to say, I'm sorry,
that
this is the companion to our very robust and successful bike lane program. Mm-hmm. So alone, if you're in a city where it's not that safe to ride bikes, et cetera, but we have created the infrastructure that welcomes this and makes it successful.
Yeah. I mean, just around here, like, I know if I walk out of Convention Center, I can think of probably about four docking stations just around here that I can get one on. That gets me, and I can get on that and get within like half a block of my house, dock it, and be able to walk just half a block to my house. That is great, and what we need to continue working on. So, Mr. Chair, thank you for bringing this item. I support continuing with this program.
Let me ask a question, and then I'll turn to you. How many residents, because you have to know this, how many residents are using the program now?
I believe we have close to 5,000 Miami Beach residents that are members. So roughly 5 or 6% of the population holds a monthly membership, which is pretty good because the rate of people who use bicycles as a main form of commuting around the country is only about 1%.
And how does that work if... Is that only Miami Beach residents, or is that Miami? Because what happens, I guess a resident can drive over and leave a bike on the mainland, right?
When you sign up, you basically are allocated. If you're Miami Beach, you put your address in, and it's Miami Beach. They are compartmentalized, even though they're interoperable.
And but right now, the fee for residents is $20 a month?
$20 a month, unlimited 30-minute rides.
Okay. So I'm Commissioner Ariel, I want to hear from you, but Commissioner Fernandez, thank you for your kind words towards the program. I too, you know, it's one of those things that I never get a complaint about this. It's really great. So we want to continue. I don't want to give free rides because I think that's very difficult to manage. However, I would certainly be willing to give up some revenue stream for maybe an additional incentives for residents. So if you have 5,000 at 20, that's about 100,000 a year. That's what I'm calculating. So if you're getting
a month.
Yeah. So we're getting 700,000 now in revenue stream. And it's wonderful that we're like one of a kind getting something, but maybe I would like to support maybe coupons or vouchers for residents to get their first month or their first 3 months for free, so that we can incentivize them to go use the thing, and then maybe there is some opportunity to give residents some sort of discount, right? And take that out of our revenue stream.
Yeah, we're able to track those things. We can issue unique promotion codes for either a short-term single rental or a membership. So I believe that we can handle the logistics of coordinating that with you guys.
Mr. Chair, I want to give the – I'm sorry. I want to give the vice chair an opportunity, but after Ricky, I just want to make
– Go ahead, Ricky.
No, I just need to – I have a lot to say, but let's move on. I'm in favor.
Okay. So are you moving the items?
Yeah, I'll move the item. I like for the administration and the provider to negotiate this. I don't want to negotiate this from the dais. I do think, a negotiation does need to take place on this, because whether it be a discount or a few free rides a month, for our residents. The thing is, those few free rides, maybe it keeps the residents coming back to the service as a mode of transportation, which is ultimately what I'm trying to get at, that we want our residents to, more than just 5,000, to continue using this as an ongoing mode of transportation. And perhaps having those handful of free rides gets us there, encourages us to do that. So I'll move the item. To continue with the program for a 5-year period. I think we want to also encourage you to negotiate that public benefit for our community. Was there anything else that we were requesting?
Well, I think that in terms of the period, you've got a month-to-month contract. You're not really guaranteed to go through December 31st. So I would say 5 years, starting January 1st of 24. So because you're not guaranteed that you're going to get all of next year if there's an RFP, right?
True. I would ask, if possible, that maybe just to push it a couple months further, like maybe April after peak season, because you wouldn't want to transition anything really on New Year's.
Listen, I think these are the details that
the administration.
Yeah, administration, work with them. If they come back and say 6 years, the 5 year starts January 1st of 25, I'm fine with that. Okay. I'll tell you another way, Commissioner Fernandez, we could deal with the free thing is, you're only giving residents free rides for up to 30 minutes. So one thing you could begin offering residents is, four times a month, you're allowed to have, up to 2 hours or something like that.
We have a deluxe membership as well. It's $5 extra a month. It gives unlimited 1 hours. So,
yeah, but what I'm saying is, rather than go the deluxe, you could say, if you could take the standard package and then four times a month, you can, exceed your time limit, and you're not going to get dinged on that. You're not going to and you can take some consideration out of the package, because one thing I would like to see is a minimum guarantee in the contract. So whether that's $500,000 or whatever it is, I mean, you can certainly afford that. If you're getting $700,000 now and we allow you to continue with your infrastructure, I'm expecting to have $700,000 or more down the road. But I think we would exchange some of that money for additional benefit for our residents. So, but those are the details you need to work out.
We can work it out.
You know, maybe offer new customers a first month or a first quarter, maybe offer existing standard memberships, three or four time extension rides for free every month, something like that is what I'm thinking. But those are the details you all can work out. So the item's been moved. It's unanimous. We'll move it back to can we be ready to act on this October 18th?
You tell me. We'll.
I think what you could do is you could have a term sheet. If you don't have a contract in place, if you're successful in negotiating, you could have a term sheet and bring it back to us on October 18th.
And we have an agreement already, so this would be an amendment to the agreement. We could.
Yeah, so these are just some of the things that Commissioner Fernandez has mentioned and, additional benefit for some residents. I would like to see a minimum guarantee in the contract, but I don't expect it to be $700,000 if you're willing to offer some of these things Commissioner Fernandez has mentioned. And so maybe the number, I don't know what it is. Is it $600,000? Is it $500,000? I don't know, but I'm not going to vote for an extension without a minimum guarantee. So, because I think that's fair to the city. But it doesn't have to be seven, because I'm happy to exchange some of the revenue for additional benefit for residents. Okay? We got what we need on the Jason.
Just wanted to summarize for the record. So the FERC is recommending the City Bike extension, the five-year extension, with the administration to discuss adding minimum guaranteed revenue and additional benefits to residents.
Yep. Thank you. Also for the administration to make a recommendation on the 5 years. If the administration is comfortable extending the contract.
The start date.
The start date so that the 5 years starts January 1st of 25. I'm okay with that. That's a detail that the administration can work out. You got what you need?
Yes, sir.
And then I want to see this. We'll move this back with a favorable recommendation subject to the terms that you come up with. For October 18th commission meeting. Okay?
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to indefinitely defer item number 16. I don't think we have $44 million or enough pool with FDEP on.
Thank you so much. We'll show that. Do you want to withdraw it or do you?
Yeah, let's withdraw.
Let's withdraw item 16, and the chair will certainly entertain any more withdrawals if anyone. These magic words.
If I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Item. It might be possible. I know we had a discussion that item 13 related to the beach walk improvements. I believe that may have been handled through the budget process. With a project
discussion regarding beachwalk pedestrian safety and so forth. Yeah, I think we did talk about that as part of the budget cycle. So
we can show it.
Let's
acted
show.
Acted and closed.
I'm sorry.
We can show it. It was discussed during the budget process and closed. Or
you know what? I always defer to the sponsor. So
okay.
Please have someone in your office reach out to the sponsor. I think it can be closed, but I would
we'll confirm with the sponsor.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So item 13, I believe, was covered, but talk to the sponsor. What is on item 11? The reason I'm curious about this, Commissioner Areola, is if there is any funding need that we need to address as part of this budget. So,
let me tee it up.
Yeah, tee it up for me.
Yeah, so... I have this on here, and Monica, I think you'll walk us through it. And this, predates your time with us. Colleagues, we talked earlier today and many, many times during all of our tenures, just about government bureaucracy, red tape, inaction, et cetera. And I've kept this on the agenda now for a couple of meetings because I wanted to highlight this as a case study of – how long and how painful it can be to get things done in our city. If you look at the memo, we had procured cameras or told the staff to get cameras in our garages dating back to 2019, and it's still not done. And there's all kinds of reasons or excuses, whatever you want to call it, why that hasn't happened. Now, the issue for me is, when we have a directive, let's get security cameras in our public garages, for public safety, which is all of our number one priorities. And security cameras are relatively easy
to procure. I've done it in my house and in my business, and there's a gazillion providers out there. Very easy RFP to do. And then it came to my attention because my aide had his bike stolen from our city garage, the one right next to City Hall. I think it was during COVID, been about a year or two. And then I found out that at least four or five other city employees had had their bikes stolen. And I said, okay, well, let's look at the cameras and see who did it. Oh, the cameras don't work. So what do you mean the cameras don't work? 2019, we said, get cameras. And then if you read the memo, it's a litany of reasons why this hasn't happened. So I wanted to have a public discussion how this happens, and then let's get the damn cameras in every single garage because it is essential for public safety. We have people parking in there, families, women and children. We've got to make those things safe. They're dark. People parking them at night. I was told by PD, please don't talk about this. We don't want people to know we don't have cameras. I'm like, how about just putting the cameras in? Like, no, that's not an acceptable answer. Mm-hmm. Put the cameras in.
Yep.
You know? If you care about public safety, we get this stuff done. So, Monica, sorry to put you on the hot spot. It's not entirely your responsibility. It's a lot of people's responsibility. But we got to get these cameras installed in all of our garages, make them operable, have them in every nook and cranny, have them high def. If it's a funding need you have, let us know what it is so we can take care of it.
Go ahead. You're recognized.
Again, good morning. So we are funded. And, you know, given my background, airports, security and safety is top of my mind. And so, yes, when I came to the city, this process was ongoing. But what we have done, though, is we've made great use of the delay, which it's alarming. But what we have done now is that we have, instead of going through a procurement process where you put out an RFQ or an RFP and people give you all sorts of equipment, et cetera, what we did is we set a standard for the city with IT and PD, right? And so we have a standard for cameras. In that process, the camera technology moves so fast, okay, that it has changed generations. But what we are getting is the latest, every nook and cranny, the angles that PD needs, very thorough study of safety in garages. And even we will have license plate recognition to come in and out of the garages. PD will know who is in that garage. So if there is a car, a search or something. So, yes, we're going to have like the Cadillac of services. It took a long time because of the desire to have a uniform standard across the city. And when you do that through procurement, you could end up with different people. So we established, with IT, and PD, a camera standard, an equipment standard. And we are well on our way. So Monica, the 17th Street Garage.
Monica, let me help because I got at least one other item I have to get to before we close out. When you say you're on your way, to Commissioner Earle's, do you have the funding that you need right now?
We do. It's fully
funded.
So
you don't need additional funds. And where are we in the procurement? Have we procured what we need?
Everything. We have the equipment in. We're in the installation process. We finished 17th Street Garage, which is the largest, prioritizing security, City Hall Garage, just about finished.
Yeah, just in deference to our PD, you don't have to say which ones. Just say,
Right.
Well, you know, by when will we have all of them? And we can leave it vague so no one knows which ones are.
Within like the next 15 months. But we've all of them.
Mr. Chair, I have a question. Because one thing is funding. But what if we have inoperative cameras, which is part of the problem here, that we've made investments in cameras, but now they're not operating properly. As part of our procurement, as part of our contracts, we don't have any guarantees in place that protect this investment that the city is making, because as part of our GOB, now our taxpayers are going to be paying for 30 years for technology that we know is kind of going to be outdated, but those are cameras that the taxpayers are going to continue paying for 30 years. What guarantees are we getting in the contracts on this technology that we're investing in for cameras?
So none of the cameras that are inoperative are under warranty. They're old systems.
Okay, so that means that we probably, you know, we can't look at the national standard for this because the national standard does not deal with the environment that we deal with here. We build things differently here because of our environment. We just use different technology and all that. And I think the same should probably apply for cameras. The warranty you may have in some other area of the country shouldn't be the same warranty that we have on the same technology here just because we're in a very saline environment. We deal with different storms and exposed to much harsher elements. Have we looked at the need as we continue investing the taxpayers' money on this technology at looking at different standards of warranty to protect these investments? Because to me, it's just why are we without warranty on these on this equipment?
I mean, this comment is not for you, Monica. It's really for the administration. I mean, to find out things are out of warranty, it is someone's job. Someone has to be accountable for screwing this up because we made the investment in the cameras. Everything has an end of useful life, so replace it. And if you don't have the funding, come to us. I remember this goes back to Chief Oates. I mean, one of the first things I did when I took office was talk to him about, hey, how do we enhance public safety? One of the things we talked about was putting cameras all throughout our city. And we funded it, and we funded it over and over again. We even funded it in the GEO bond. And now I find out that our garages, you know, which we completely control, it's very natural to have cameras in our garages. We don't have it. Now I'm being told it's another 15 months. I mean, it is a level of incompetence that's not acceptable to me. Like, why can't we have this done in 3 months? I mean, seriously, we have to get it done much faster than 15 months.
Commissioner, so what I'm saying is there were eight garages that were remaining. Now there are six. So they're saying 6 to 8 weeks to get all the wiring and all the cameras up and going. I will absolutely work with them to see if we could do in tandem various. By the way, we have been doing that. We are doing the infrastructure in some, while in the others we're installing cameras. I'm just being totally honest because if you're going to do six garages, then you know, but we have made great progress. We're working towards it.
All you need is one rape shooting to make this a worthwhile investment. So 15
well
months
aware.
Is not acceptable. It's the technology is there. I mean, this is literally off the shelf. You hire somebody and they install them. I mean, this is not a complicated thing. Do them all in tandem, but get it done. If it costs a premium, we'll pay for
six,
it.
Six to 8 weeks per garage. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
But why to the commissioner? Why can't it be done in tandem? Because can you explore that and get back to me? Because if I need to present a budget item, I'd like to know what it would cost to accelerate this. If there is any cost, maybe there's no cost at all. Maybe it's just us telling the contractor doing the work, hey, get two teams out there instead of one team, and let's get it done.
And I need information on the warranty.
We'll get that to you.
I want to make sure that what we are investing in is protected for the appropriate amount of time.
All right, and also, just, you know, it should go without saying, but let me say it. Make sure that when we install these cameras, it is every nook and cranny, inside and outside, because what I don't want to hear about, hey, a car got stolen, but it was in the one blind spot that we didn't have, because that's what the story is going to be next. Like, make sure these cameras really get all of the pertinent areas of the garage, inside and out. There's no reason we shouldn't have them on the outside, too, paroling the streets. I mean, if it costs a premium to get the ones that, you know, automatically patrol and or, you know, if PD is going to be manning this at some point, you know, if they have to be joystick controlled, I mean, let's get the Cadillac and make our public spaces safe.
Yeah, let's do it.
If I can summarize, because we've run out
of time.
The item was discussed noon. The project's fully funded and ongoing. FERC requested the project to be expedited. Administration to get Commissioner Fernandez information on warranties and the chair information on additional budget needs if needed to expedite the project.
Exactly. So we have run out of time, but I do very quickly, I need, because it's a budget-related item. Commissioner Riola had item number two. I just want to know... if this is This is related to the screen, the pump, and I just need to know if there's anything I need to deal with as chair of putting this budget together. What, where are we at, Joe, quickly on this?
Yes,
and
sir.
What kind of money if is needed, if any at all?
What we're recommending is two things. Giving the landscaping another 12 months to grow to maturity to be able to cover the assorted equipment in there, and also in the gate. I know that was a concern of Commissioner Ariola's. I think we found a solution working with our facilities group, similar enclosure to what they did at Ocean Drive and 10th for some of the equipment and the fire risers that are out there. It's a louvered type of enclosure, so we can do that at the gate, because the gate we cannot cover with landscaping. We have to have access to it. So that's about a cost. We're estimating about $5,000 or so. We can handle that through
You've
our
got
operation.
That in your operation budget.
Yes,
okay.
Sir.
With that, we'll. Can I show that item closed then? Okay. Thank you very much. And with that, we will stand adjourned. I want to thank our first responders, police, for being here to support us today. Thank you very much.
And Mr. Chair, thank you for accommodating the schedule.
Absolutely,
I really
my pleasure.
It.
My pleasure. And we'll see everybody back October 16th at 9:30 a.m. Thank you.